Oh, hang on, let me turn the video on. Can you hear me?
I can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hello. Let me see if I see myself. Oh, there I am. I'm pretty backlit.
It's like I'm interviewing like a whistleblower.
Yes, that's it. Exactly. You're just talking that weird voice.
It's like we're in The Guardian right now.
That's it. That's good. Let me move to a better background here. All right, cool. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, my pleasure. How's it going? How are things across the Atlantic?
I mean, politically, not great right
Yeah,
now.
yeah. It's fair to say.
You might have heard some of the stories coming out.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's a race to the finish between our lot and your lot.
Listen, one of these two crazy-looking men is going to crash their own economy first, and it's just a race to find out who it's going to be.
I think the finale of Earth is going particularly well right now.
It's very exciting.
It is. It's all to play for in the final round. Cool. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. This is going to be a really good episode, I feel.
Oh, wonderful! Thank you. That's I hope to not disappoint.
Well, there's a lot riding on it, so.
Yeah, I'm gonna do my best. Listen, you've had people from South Park. You've had my cousin. I might be like, distant second in my own bloodline. So I really got to bring it today.
I'm just working through your family tree. I thought that was
Yes.
a not at all creepy thing to do.
My father would love to talk to you, I'm sure. Okay, various uncles.
Wonderful. All big late night players, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I've actually wanted for a long time, I probably shouldn't give this away, but I've wanted to set up an email account at either it probably wouldn't work for the Daily Show, but if I ever could do it somewhere else, a thing called Parent Pitch, where it's an email address where the parents can just pitch all their ideas to the show. I feel like it would be fun on like Conan or one of those where like, and then you produce the ideas that the parents have sent to their kids who are writers and producers and whatever it is. I feel like that would be a lot of fun. And then bring the parents out to explain why they thought it was funny and whatever. And I feel like some of them would legit be funny, and then I think some would be unintentionally funny. So either way.
Many people would be disowned in the process, but that's all part of the creative flow. I think that would work. I think they've done a lot with kids pitching ideas and telling jokes, and I can't remember a time when it's been the other end of the family tree.
Yeah, it's an entire branch of the tree that's missing out.
Wonderful. Well, that's an exclusive first take. copyright it now.
That's it.
Millionaire by the morning.
Oh, awesome.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'll kick off then.
Oh, wonderful.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest this week is a titan of American satirical comedy. After getting his start at The Onion, he's gone on to become one of the longest-serving writers of The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, writing for it since Trevor took over the show from Jon Stewart. He's also written for Kenan Thompson when he hosted the NHL Awards, and he himself has hosted the New York Video Game Awards, not just once, not just twice, not just four times, but three times. As I touch upon in a moment, this is the first episode recorded in two places at once, with Devin speaking in his New York home, and me in the global headquarters of Spieling the Beans, a small village in southern England. As you can imagine, our conversation gets a tad political. It's worth pointing out that this interview was recorded on the 29th of August 2019, the day after Boris Johnson prorogued Parliament, the Amazon is burning, the G7 has just wrapped, and Kirsten Gillibrand has just withdrawn from the 2020 race. Neither of us are overly enthusiastic about the situations in the UK and the US. Of course, a world away from how it is now. Well, anyway, aside from politics, our conversation covers everything from how Trump has changed late night, what people don't tell you about hosting award shows until you're doing it, what it's like writing jokes that play to the audience at home versus those that play to the audience in the room, why stories are vital in both light and dark times, and how not wanting to dissect a fetal pig led him on the road to comedy. It'll all make sense when you hear him say it, don't worry. So anyway, please welcome my guest for this week, ladies and gentlemen, Devin Delaquanti. Devin, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Now, this is a double first for the show because I think it's our first transatlantic interview.
Oh, wonderful.
And our first one where a guest has been talked about by a previous guest.
Oh, that's fun.
We had your cousin Gabe on a few episodes ago.
Yes.
And he mentioned a bit about how you got started, but perhaps in your own words you could explain how you took the slightly unconventional route of, I believe, insurance firm to the Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm glad we got this in before Brexit really kicks in, because with a hard Brexit, we don't know if we would be able to do this across the Atlantic. So there'd be various tariffs we'd have to go, you know, deal with, and I'd probably have to sneak in across the border of Ireland to Northern Ireland to, you know. So I appreciate it. Yeah, my I took a kind of circuitous route to the late night world. I worked at an accounting firm called KPMG, which was, I worked there for 4 years, 4.5 years, sort of temp to perm. But I had gone to art school, which, you know, various adults will tell you as you're going to is not always the most practical decision, but I felt good about it and I was happy to do it. And then out of art school, I kind of, was acting and writing and kind of found stand-up and sketch. And then KPMG was my day job. And so I worked there and just sort of, you know, did all the things you do when you're grinding and trying to, you know, make it in the world of comedy or the arts or whatever it is. And eventually I landed an internship at the Onion News Network, working as a video editor, like an assistant editor kind of, because their interns did a lot of the work at that time. I think it's still the case. But yeah, so then I just worked in post-production that was like 10 years ago. It was like 10 years ago right now. That's crazy. I knew how to edit in Final Cut just from making sketches and things like that. So then got to The Onion, worked as an intern there, then worked as an assistant editor on the pilot of their show that became The Onion Sports Dome, then bounced and then got hired as kind of like a post-production manager for the website when they split off to do two different TV shows. So they kind of like had a couple openings. So worked at the website, worked on Sports Dome, the TV show, worked on the second season of the Onion News Network. Then when the Onion decided to move to Chicago, it kind of like got rid of all their permanent staff and a couple people moved. And I ended up at VH1 through a colleague at the Onion working at a morning show. Then worked there as an associate producer, just like pulling footage and things like that. Then eventually got promoted to doing creative stuff, like pitching segments and doing guest interviews and talking to, you know, everybody from Stephen Merchant was one of the most exciting people I produced. And like Stephen Merchant, Chrissy Teigen, Steve Van Zandt from the E Street Band. We had Alanis Morissette on. Benedict Cumberbatch. He was really fun. I'm trying to make this as British as I can with Stephen Merchant and Benedict Cumberbatch appealing across the pond. But it was great. And like, you know, it was this kind of weird rinky-dink show that started out in a hallway and then ended up down in the old TRL studio and like at the MTV mothership. And it was really fun. And there was sort of not that many of us on the creative side. It was a pretty small team. So we were doing all the pre-interviews and producing everything. Now with The Daily Show, you know, there's a team that deals with talent and does the pre-interviews. And then we do guest questions and it's more of a collaboration. But there you just kind of had free reign to write the segments, get them approved, then pitch them to the guests who are coming on. It was really a lot of fun. So I was there for, I think, 4 years total, like 2011 to 2015, kind of like making my way up the chain. And then through that show, I ended up getting a submission packet for the Daily Show and for other shows too. I submitted once for the Daily Show in like end of 2013, beginning of 2014, then submitted for Colbert, submitted for this show on Fusion that I worked at briefly. And then once the VH1 show, it was going to move to Los Angeles, but then it got canceled. And as it got canceled, I had gotten an interview at The Daily Show through two packets when Trevor was taking over. And I was getting the text messages that they officially canceled the VH1 show as I was going to my interview for The Daily Show. So it was like, okay, this is the perfect like chapter end, chapter begin. And that was 4 years ago, right about now. So, that is my circuitous path from the accounting firm. Oh, and I left the accounting firm somewhere in there. I wasn't working two jobs the whole time. Once I got hired at The Onion sort of full time, I left the accounting firm and kind of took the leap to what felt like a firm stone under my feet. And it just kind of like jumped from thing to thing since.
The accounting firm don't feel you're still on your lunch break and you're just taking the piss now.
They might know. I don't know. I have to check to see if I'm still collecting wages from them, but I'm not going to make them the wiser if they think I'm still working there. But no, my wife actually still works there. That's where we met. So, I still see a bunch of people from there. That's good. Yeah, and they were very supportive of stand-up. They would all, you know, I would let them know that I was doing spots and everything, and people would come through. It was good. It was a cool place to work.
So it was, you were always interested in comedy, even whilst at the accounting firm. It wasn't a sort of Damascus sudden sort of epiphany.
Yeah, I was always kind of moving towards it. You know, my best friend in high school and I, in ninth grade, we had the choice of dissecting a fetal pig or making a creative video if we wanted. So we're like, oh, we'll make a video of the cardiovascular system. And we were just doing like Simpsons inspired things about, you know, Troy McClure type jokes. And so, it was like, all right, comedy seems like a good path. a way to avoid, you know, practical learning that maybe we're not as into. So, I've kind of always been into it. And, you know, when you go to drama school, you learn everything from, you know, Shakespeare, Chekhov, Harold Pinter, all different styles of things. Michael Frayn, one of my favorite playwrights, and you work on that stuff. But I think as you get into the, just into the kind of ocean of New York City afterwards, it's easy, you know, you can put up a sketch show and it's more entertaining than having people come watch you do, you know, Look Back in Anger or, you know, Cymbeline or whatever when you're a, you know, 21-year-old kid and, you know, putting it together with your friends. And, you know, those could be great productions, but comedy was just sort of, it was fun. It was always fun to do. And a lot of my friends gravitated towards it so we could just put on a big show together.
Oh, fantastic. So how important would you say story is to comedy?
Man, I think for what we do at the Daily Show, it's very important. You know, we really prioritize take, which is kind of a different part of story. Like you're telling, it's sort of like the framing that you put around any particular story that you're telling. Like, for example, you know, some days we'll just be like, okay, here are the things that happen and do jokes off of them, you know, ABC. But I think what the Daily Show really does best, and I think has always done best under, you know, John and Trevor and maybe Kilbourne, I don't remember, but is when it's all, there's kind of like a thesis and you prove it. Like the last episode we did before our break was a big headline about how all of Trump's immigration policies are actually aimed at Melania. And, you know, that she came in, you know, he talks about visa fraud and she came in on an Einstein visa and maybe like had to go back and forth, which was not the right visa for work. Then he had, you know, he's trying to crack down on chain migration, which is where you bring your family members in. But her in-laws came in the last 2 years via chain migration, like she sponsored them. So, you know, we had jokes like he's trying to turn his in-laws into outlaws and stuff like that. So, you know, that was kind of the organizing principle of that headline. And we're not necessarily telling, you know, a linear story of like he did this and then he did this and he did this. But like it's the having organizing principles of those things, I find is very important to the comedy that we do. And other than that, you know, I think it's kind of a crapshoot. Like I think of comedians like Mitch Hedberg and Stephen Wright and how those were just, you know, loose one-liners and they made me laugh as hard as anything else. And then, you know, sometimes you watch old, you know, comedies, you know, Caddyshack or whatever it is. It's like the story is so secondary, but it's more like character can be important or, you know, individual jokes can be important. You know, when someone hosts an award show, like I watched the VMAs this week and it inspired me to go back and watch Chris Rock's opening monologue from the VMAs in 99. It was just, you know, it's just ferocious and he's not necessarily telling a story throughout, but the jokes were so funny and it was such a moment in time. So it really depends on what you're trying to achieve and who your audience is and what your audience expects. But yeah, I think in general for what I do and what we do at The Daily Show, having a take and unfolding that take in a way that brings the audience along with you and escalates the right way, that's very important. So that's sort of a way to answer your question, I guess. I hope it answers it.
It's a very cohesive answer to it. And that's a brilliant segue onto the next question, which is you, of course, wrote for and then later hosted the New York Video Game Awards, as well
yes.
as writing for Keenan for the NHL Awards.
Yes.
What is the process in constructing a host monologue, and what is something that people don't tell you about it until they're actually doing it?
Oh, that's a good question. I've done the the Game Awards 3 times. And it's been kind of a challenge because there's only so many games per year and not everyone's played all of them. It's not like the Oscars where, like, generally the room has seen all the Oscar contenders. You know, you have games that are like 60 hours and people don't know it. So you kind of have to do things that you know will work everywhere. I think the big thing is knowing the audience, knowing what the people in the room will get, know what the people watching at home will get, and kind of trying to cater to both and really starting strong. I think, you know, that's a good rule in comedy with anything, but just sort of teeing up just tonally while you're there. I think, you know, the first joke Keenan did at the NHL Awards was, you know, I am Keenan Thompson. I'll be your host tonight. And for the last time, I'm not one of the Subans. And like, there's two African-American, actually, I think they're Canadian, two black players, PK Subban and Malcolm Subban, who are brothers. PK is, you know, this incredible defenseman. Been on The Daily Show, too. And played for Nashville and played for Jersey. And he's very well known throughout the league. He's one of the stars of the league. And then his brother, Malcolm. So it just seemed like a joke that could work in the room, a joke that could kind of like set the tone for the night, a joke that's like about race, but not about race, and about race in hockey, but also like lighthearted enough. And it just, like, I thought that was a good sort of handshake to the, like, hey, here's like the level of edginess we're gonna deal with. And yeah, you know, I like being a little, I think people like being ribbed without it being too mean. One of the jokes that did really well from the NHL Awards was about the Tampa Bay Lightning. And they tied the record for the most regular season wins, but then they got swept in the first round of the playoffs, so they won 0. So it was a joke that was like, you know, they tied the record for the least wins with 0. He's like, that's what I like about them. Win or lose, they set records. And the thing that, like, you can't anticipate in the writing is that they cut away to the players. And the goalie is like, Andrei Vasilevsky was just like stone-faced. And they were like not amused, but everyone was so amused by how not amused they look. And, you know, then Twitter loves a thing like that. So yeah, you know, you kind of want to be cheeky with them. And so it's sort of about like walking that line and trying not to be overly mean to the point of cruelty, especially when people are there nervous that they're going to like win something or lose something or whatever it is. And keeping the energy up, you know, people are there to have a good time and not going too long, not overwriting, you know, they're not, you're there to make it fun, not to be the center attraction. And, you know, people want to see who wins the awards and all that. So, yeah, and I think, what else? Advice about writing for those shows. It's also a volume game. Like, you just got to write as many jokes as possible and kind of keep them sharp and know what the topics you want to hit are. And it's been cool to be on either side of it. Like, for the Game Awards, I've hosted it 3 years. And then for the most recent year, just to, like, have a little extra oomph in the material, I had Gabe Malika, my cousin, like, write a couple jokes. And it was really good stuff. And it's great to have fresh eyes on that. And, you know, I've worked on, you know, Trevor hosts the Oscars, so he asks for a couple, or not hosts the Oscars, he presents at the Oscars, excuse me. So, you know, he'll ask for like one or two things, and, you know, he comes with stuff himself, obviously, but then we'll send him stuff. Or like when Michelle Wolf did the correspondence dinner, I sent a couple things to her, and you just sort of learn to like figure out what the topics are and try to think of like the best, quickest jokes you can do for a scenario like that. And, you know, Keenan was received very well for the NHL Awards, whereas Michelle Wolf, it was like, you know, one of the most, they don't do comedy at the correspondence dinner anymore. And, you know, it depends on who your audience is. You know, I think Colbert kind of blazed that trail however many years ago, 2006 or 7 or whenever it was, when it was like he knew that there was an audience outside that room. And I think Michelle knew that too. And so it's about balancing who you want your audience to be in that scenario. You know, I think Michelle is just a murderer when it comes to comedy. She just, you know, she will burn it to the ground. Like, it is like, if they didn't want that performance, my God, why did they bring her? But like, it was the best. Oh my God, it was so fun and so funny and so great to watch. But again, it's like, who's the audience for it? Like, Michelle Wolf was doing it for the audience that Michelle Wolf plays to. And it was super funny and effective as an event host in my mind. So you write jokes, but you also kind of have to have a sense of what the audience is and what you want the effect to be.
It seems insane that they would book Michelle for that. Because with yeah. Colbert, it kind of made sense that they'd seen a bit of the Colbert Report, weren't sure, sure that it was an act. But mm-hmm. there's not like a facade that Michelle seems to put on.
Look, I... Of all the insane decisions that they make in Washington, I'm not surprised they made another one when it came to booking a comedian, but or hiring the wrong people for what they expected, you know, it's or, you know, anything like that. But, you know, I think from my point of view, like Michelle was the best hire they could have made. She's just pure flames when it comes to comedy, you know, and I don't know why they thought that. I don't know what they thought they were going to get. I really don't.
Was the joke you gave to her the smoky eye one?
No. I did not. That was I had no hand in that one. But I had just given her a couple things here and there about CNN and about Megyn Kelly and, you know, just general kind of things. I don't even remember which ones she used, you know, at this point, but it's strange, but they don't vet there anymore. So I don't know. It's pretty odd. I think that aside from they're not vetting people and like making a hiring decision, that's not the best, in terms of hiring her as a comedian based on what they expected, like they love to play the victim. They love to pretend that they're being victimized or that, you know, that they're being censored and that the press is after them or that the victims of a migration crisis are Americans and, you know, whether it be violence or whatever. And I think that while what they expected from Michelle is not what they got, it did give Sarah Sanders and then by extension the administration the ability to play the victim. And they just love doing that. They, you know, it's a thing we see all over the place. You know, with the Fed chairman, like he's a victim of what the Fed chairman that he appointed has done with interest rates. It's like, all right, fine, like play the victim in that too, you know. But yeah, it just fits in the larger causal web of that whole victim act that they love to do.
It's a trick that they seem to be replicating this side too, which mm-hmm. is forcing the EU's hand to.
Yeah,
they have not strayed as a 27 country organization. Not straight yeah. since the first meeting, and yeah. they've managed to twist it, going, "Oh, if it weren't for them, we'd get that unicorn we promised." But bloody right, unicorn right. killers over there!
Ugh. Yeah. Do you think? Because I've heard, well, I can't remember what. Oh, I was listening to a Council on Foreign Relations podcast. Do you think that a hard Brexit will really be chaos the way they think, or do you think it will be? Is it being overblown enough that it will? That people will be like, see, it wasn't so bad. And then they'll get the benefit of that doubt. Because that's the one thing I'm always concerned about is like, it's going to be chaos. People are going to be dying because they can't get their medicine. If that happens, obviously it's terrible and you want to prevent that. But if it is reported that that's going to happen and then that doesn't happen, does it then erode the confidence in a media that's trying to prevent these, you know, trying to report the real risks of a hard Brexit?
Sure.
Where do you fall with this whole?
It's in short, yes, it would be that bad. The problem is that you fall into a catch-22, which is either it'll be so bad that people will actually die, or mm-hmm. people will do everything they can to prevent that, and then the people who wanted the hard Brexit in the first place will go, well, see what you were complaining about.
It's
a very good comparison is with Y2K and that bug, because
right.
everyone went, well, it was fine, nothing went wrong. And then yeah. every computer programmer I've met in the last 6 years has gone, no, we stayed up for like 8 months solid recoding everything. Yeah, which I didn't know about, which isn't really talked about. But
yeah.
Tens of thousands of coders around the world had to manually recode everything so that it
really?
Wouldn't. Yeah, so it wouldn't implode. And then it didn't, people go, well, it was fine, what were we worried about? And
yeah.
I think that'll be, feel free to pitch that. On the show is a good, good metaphor. But it is exactly that case. But if it is as bad as that, I mean, like you were saying, insulin wouldn't be able to reach people, so they would not be able to survive.
Right.
Because it has to be kept at a certain degree thing at the base, and they have to ship it over, and so it's very time-pressured. They're looking at queues of lorries going sort of weeks delayed rather than a couple of minutes.
Right, because there's no rules getting through customs or whatever.
Exactly. And so there is, it's all very sort of, if you view it from the perspective of, is there a nefarious separate power, Russia, wanting chaos in order to seem the most stable in the world, is this what he'd want? You go, oh, it kind of is.
Yeah.
And it does seem to be the sort of the mirror image of what's happening with your good self and your good people.
Yeah.
And over here. So it's, but yeah, so either it will be cataclysmic or it won't be. And then people who push for the cataclysm will go, oh, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Wow. I feel like there's similar feelings about the recession that might be looming in America, which is obviously like no one is rooting for a recession to happen. But a recession before 2020 would be bad for Trump. So there becomes this paradox where it's like, if there is a recession, then it'll be like, oh, the media wanted this recession.
Yeah.
But then if there isn't, it's like we prevented this recession that's being, you know, obviously the tariffs and the debt that America's taking on and trade war, all that, you know, and then the bad economic decisions that they've made, which is an opinion, but I'm happy to express it. And I don't know. Like, where do you fall? Does everybody take the proper precautions to prevent the bad thing? Or do you let the bad decisions that bad decision makers have made truly, do you let them see those decisions through? It is a paradox and a catch-22, like you say. So I don't know the answer. We'll find out in 6 months.
In the next episode. It's a fantastic political tool to blame your failings on your counterpart.
Yes.
If it doesn't go wrong, you're the hero. If it does go wrong, they're the villain.
Exactly, yeah. It's that victim thing.
But anyway, let's keep it light. Let's keep it light.
Yes,
absolutely.
Well, you joined The Daily Show in 2015, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you managed to see it both pre and, well, mid-Trump. Hopefully mid, dear Lord.
Yeah.
How has he...
Can't be mid if there's no ending.
Well, it's all mid.
The nature of infinity is such, and I think there is no, I think the sun will die out before he finishes whatever it is he's doing, but yeah.
Well, then his tan will even look more false. So how has he affected late night from an insider's point of view?
He consumes so much of the oxygen in the rooms, you know, particularly for a political comedy show. We just didn't want to be doing this. I mean, I think people, there is that perception that, you know, all the late night shows, they only talk about Trump or that. But I mean, he fed on that in the cable news. And then now, like, he just is pure chaos in the news cycle. And everything is kind of reactive to him and all that. And, you know, there are days where we really don't focus on him. And I think some of our better, like, not better shows, but just the shows where we really mix it up, it's been fun lately, like doing headlines about, you know, the Sackler family and opioids and that, like diving into that stuff. And, you know, Hassan's show does that and Oliver's show does that. But it's just, I mean, it's like living through Caligula and you don't talk about Caligula. Like, you know, if you're a jester in ancient Rome, it's like, you know, all right, I mean, he appointed us horse. What are we going to talk about? You know, the conditions in the stables at the, you know, the gladiator, are we going to talk about Caligula? So there's that. And I'm sure it's true across all the late night shows, is like, it's just a matter of finding new things to talk about or, you know, new joke angles or whatever it is, you know, the hair and the tan, like we've been doing that for 2.5 years. So finding new angles on those things is always a challenge. But the thing that's fun now is, you know, you have such a big crop of Democratic candidates, and I think we really leaned into covering them and there's characters is a weird word to use about it, but they're kind of emerging as this is all going on. And, you know, people are dropping out. Kirsten Gillibrand dropped out yesterday, and I can't even keep track of all of them at this point. But like Seth Bullock is still in. Michael Bennett's pissed off that he's not making it into the next debate. So, you know, it's just kind of the whole fight between Biden and Kamala. And it's been nice to pivot away and to see new people. And I think that's another thing about The Daily Show is little things will pop up and we'll follow them and they'll really be fun to cover, and there's a lot of fun to be had. Like, you know, we cover all the Trump stuff, but then there's like the Jussie Smollett story, and it just is like so insane. And, and it's like tangentially related to Trump in that, you know, he faked the thing, but God, like, it was just so incompetent the way he put it. A hate crime against himself to get a raise. It just, the other one that I remember was, year and a half ago was the whole Roy Moore thing. And then, you know, when obviously the Trump stuff is the Trump stuff, but then it's like, wait, this guy was banned from the mall? Like, he couldn't go. And every time it was just like, I had never been at that place. And I've never been to that diner where they said I was inappropriate. And then you'd just be like, hey, we found a picture of him winning the pancake challenge at the diner. Yeah. Just stuff like that, you know, the fact that Trump is so all-consuming really makes those other stories that pop so much fun. I mean, Aunt Becky from Full House, you know, cheated her daughter into USC, and then she's an influencer, and she's like on, you know, pretended she's on the crew team. It just, oh my God, like that, it really makes that stuff so much more fun to cover because we get to put away, you know, the drudgery of a lot of the Trump things. But then when you find the don't deport Melania thing, you know, it's really rewarding because you think, oh, we really made a thing that is a new take on all of it, and you know, and can kind of be gleeful amidst stuff that is, when you stare at it in a, you know, in its truth, it can be very sad and hard to cover, and you think of the people involved. But you know, our job is to show up and make comedy every day. So yeah, that's. Yeah, it's crazy. I can't remember if someone said it or if it's just been the way that I've been looking at it. But the Trump thing, people are always like, oh, you know, it's like, is it fun covering Trump, or, you know, you must make your job easy. It's like, it's not easy. It's just busy. Like, it's like a doctor in an Ebola outbreak. You're like, I don't like this. I'm busy. Like, I wish I could just be giving like flu shots or whatever, but you know, this is what I have to do. And then, you know, ideally maybe one day we go back to like, all right, maybe we'll work on more longer term solutions. But that's sort of the way it's been covering all the Trump madness.
I remember Jon Stewart saying something about how it's useful for him to have the show because it allows him to process what's going on and not just scream into a pillow. Do you find that too?
Absolutely. And especially when I hang out with friends of mine who are not in the late night world, it is easy to get bogged down by the darkness of everything that's happening and the chaos of all of it. But, you know, over the past 4 years, I've really just, like, it's my job to process these things into comedy and, like, grind all that chaos and sadness in the news cycle into comedy sausage. And that's, it's sort of trained my brain to work that way, and it makes it a little easier. It's certainly hard on given days, but, you know, there's examples where the budget came out in like 2018, I want to say 2017 or 2018, they released a budget, and there were huge increases to the Defense Department and then cuts to Meals on Wheels. So the natural, if you think about like, oh, there are old people who need food who are not going to get it, it's like terribly sad. But when you have like comedy brain on, we immediately went to like, oh, well, then the answer is to militarize Meals on Wheels. So you just like have tanks that go around on the streets delivering hot food to old people. And, you know, it's a relief, you know, it's a way to deal with how awful those decisions are and to show the absurdity of what, you know, that priority for a society. So yeah, it's been helpful to have the show as an outlet for myself through this and to just put it out there and deal with all the just insane stories that happen, you know, that we see multiple times per day now. So,
well, I'm glad that it's able to provide you with that level of comfort and limit the therapy cost.
Yeah, and it's also like it's not the other thing is like, it's not the full part of our life. Like that's the job, but then you can also deal with it in other ways and like support causes that you believe in and, you know, candidates or not or whatever. But like, you can make jokes about the Sackler family and all that and, you know, compare them to like Narcos and redubbing Narcos footage, and which is one of the things we did on the show. But then like supporting treatment centers and all that, you know, that's there are practical things you can still do in your life. It's not the only outlet, nor should it be the only outlet to deal with things that you believe are wrong on, you know, whatever your political affiliations may be. But yeah, it certainly helps as one side of that.
That's very inspiring. How do you find, you're welcome. How do you find writing factual satire as opposed to writing fictional satire that you had with The Onion?
Oh, yeah. I never got to really write at The Onion. It was more just pitched, like, if I ever was on the creative side of it, I was doing graphics things and that type of thing. But it's a little more restrictive. I feel like I'm a little better at the fact side of it, because I always enjoyed, you know, the 5-paragraph essay and that type of thing when I was in college, and kind of taking evidence and piecing it together and then building an argument and, you know, threading things through and doing, you know, kind of working structurally. Like, I always enjoyed that type of writing. So it kind of lends itself to the things that I do at the show. I feel like just the way that The Onion can take things to crazy town is, you know, I don't think anyone is as good as they are and as consistently funny as they are at doing that type of thing. But I just like writing things based on reality, because it forces you to keep up with the news. Even, you know, I'm on a break right now, but like, I'll just always be kind of like looking at stuff and pitching and trying to think of takes and angles and kind of squirrel things away for later when we're back on. And I like it a little better. I think it's a case by case. You know, I don't think everyone at the show necessarily feels that way. I think that's one of the reasons that our writer's room is cool, is like, we have so many different voices that I think some people could take or leave, like staring at the news thing. But at the end of the day, we all have to like show up and write jokes. And the way that you approach it is it's better to have a lot of people with a lot of different points of view and a lot of different ways to grind out comedy every day. And I just happen to be one of the people that likes really doing, news-based, following stuff. And we've had a couple writers actually come out of our deep dive department too. So, you know, some of them are stand-up, some of them are journalists. So we get a real mix of that, which is good and fun and helpful as, as one cog in the machine.
Do you remember the first joke you wrote?
At Daily Show or in general?
Both.
I knew you were going to say that. I should have anticipated. First joke I wrote. The first joke I got on at the Daily Show, I think, because technically we had like a couple weeks of like prep shows with Trevor. So the first show that we did was, I think, the Pope was in town and Paul Ryan... No, John Boehner was resigning as Speaker of the House, and Paul Ryan was taking over.
The yippity-doo-dah.
Say again?
The yippity-doo-dah moment.
Yes, absolutely. Zippity-doo-dah, that's right. I forgot about that, God, because news is an avalanche. But I got on the OTS that night, I think, which is the over-the-shoulder. It's like the title of the thing that's usually a pun.
Yeah,
that thing. We call that the OTS, the over the shoulder.
The graphic that goes over.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to think of some good ones as examples. But it was a basic one. The movie Steve Jobs was coming out, and so I pitched Leave Jobs in the document. And so they went with Leave Jobs, and I had spent so many years loving those puns in the OTS, and I like puns in general. So, I got that on, and it was a pun. And I was like, oh, that was pretty good. It was my little contribution to Trevor's first show, especially like, you know, back then I was so new, and you know, you're kind of like, am I doing this right? And, you know, am I gonna get stuff on? What kind of jokes work, and like what kind of jokes for Trevor work? And it was nice to just get one of those on in the early show. I think it was the first show, I can't remember, I have to go back and look, but yeah, I got that on. And then my first joke in stand-up, I'm trying to remember. I did a joke about wanting an iPhone, because they were like way out of my price range back then. And they were so, like, it was so expensive when it came out, and it felt irresponsible. And I was like, I don't know about this. So I did a joke about wanting an iPhone. And then I did a joke about don't ask, don't tell, which was still the law of the land at that point in like 2007, I want to say.
Wow.
Yeah. What are the other jokes I did? I can't remember.
Presumably they were the same joke, the don't ask, don't tell, and wanting an iPhone.
No. Yeah, they were separate checks. Yeah, I don't even remember. Something about, I just remember doing an act out about Rosie from the Jetsons. The iPhone. Yeah. Let me see if I have it. I wonder if, because I have all my old sets, because I hoard everything. Oh, yeah.
So well, have you got them written down, or do you take recordings?
Yeah, yeah. I keep a folder of everything. Oh, man. Yeah, open mic set one, September 10, 2007. Oh, my God, this is funny. Let's see. Oh, I did a joke about John Mayer doing stand-up. That was funny. I mean, funny, not funny, but, you know, it's funny that
What's
I tell.
What's the joke?
Let me read it. Let's see if it's
if it's broadcastable.
I love stand up my whole life. Oh, so I mean, as I think you do, I'm talking about being new to stand up, which not a really good open when you're trying to inspire confidence in a room full of people trying to get to laugh at you. It's like, hey, I'm new at this. Like going into surgery and being like, hey, this is the first time I've ever cut somebody open, so strap in. Not what you want to hear on the gurney. So I talk about that I'm gonna take the half Italian coward angle as cornering the market on that. I kind of stuck with that, I guess. These aren't really jokes, it's just like meandering. I can say is that I'm one of those OCD restless legs, carry my life in a shoulder bag with me at all time kind of guys. Again, not really a joke, but at least a setup to my what I am. I'll give you an example. Oh, inside my shoulder bag, I once spilled KY jelly all over my pocket dictionary. Yeah, and then a whole thing about about John Mayer doing stand-up and talking about how he just sleeps with, like, pop stars all the time. And then this would be, like, Hugh Hefner doing stand-up in his, like, red velvet bathrobe being like, what's the deal with blondes wanting to have sex all the time with me? That was sort of the ender of that thing. So, yeah, that was my first from my first set, what do you know? Good thing I hoard all this stuff.
Yeah, what was the last time you read that?
Oh, God, I don't even know. Maybe, I mean, it's got to be 10 years, right? Jeez.
Wow. So you write it down as sort of a chunk of prose, or are there sort of key words?
Yeah, I would always write very long. I just tend to type everything. It's maybe it's not the best. Like, I would occasionally work things out on stage, but I would always just put all the words down. And I think, especially when I got hired at The Daily Show, I learned to just cut words, just less words, less words, less words. And even looking at that, it's just like, oh my God, fewer words, more jokes. Yeah, but it's kind of fun to go back and look at it. And it's, you know, it's not that like it comes automatically at this point, but yeah, just getting things honed down is important and took me a while, I think, to really learn how to do. But yeah, it's weird. It's weird to go back and look at it.
Can you remember the feeling of going up on stage that first time?
Yeah, I think it went all right. Like, it was certainly fun. And it's funny, the friend of mine, Mark Stetson, he works at Mashable. He makes videos at Mashable. We did the video about the cardiovascular system in lieu of dissecting a he actually was there. He had done stand-up before I did, and he came up doing it in Chicago. And so he and I went together, and then we were doing stand-up together a lot from like 2007 till 2009. And it went pretty well. And, you know, he kind of like Sherpa'd me through the very early early periods. And it was a lot like the show Crashing, like early in the show Crashing, which it was a lot of those same kind of venues and that feeling. And, you know, people that we were in that scene with ended up on that show, like a comedian named Todd Montesi. And then, you know, Jamie Lee was kind of in and around that, you know, that level of comedy. She was a little above us in terms of like where she was and the types of shows she was doing. But it was very bizarre watching that show, because it felt like what we went through. And it was like the same rooms recreated, and, you know, jokes bombed the way that they bombed in our real life. And then when things hit, they hit the same way. But it felt good. Like I had written sketch stuff and done theater for so long that stand-up was freeing, and that's like, oh, you really don't have to produce anything. You can just do the jokes and see if a premise will work. And I remember just taking things that I thought were sketch ideas and putting them out of stand-up, and that's so freeing. Like, you can just paint a whole picture or create a whole scene or tell a whole story through stand up or, you know, or do one liners or whatever it is. But it's, you just need the microphone. I saw Nas in concert last night and he taught, you know, all he needs is one mic. And it's true for stand up. All you need is one mic, unless you're Neil Brennan, in which case you need three mics. But that's still good. It's still low overhead.
Would you say you're more of a narrative comedian or a one liner one, or how would you characterize?
More narrative. I kind of like the five paragraph joke, I guess, which is, I mean, it makes sense that I ended up at The Daily Show for that, or it makes sense that I wanted to be at The Daily Show, put it that way. It doesn't always make sense that I ended up there. I've always like, been amazed that it happened. But my wife and I had our first child last September, and, you know, I kept sort of notes for myself and everything. And then, it was both personal things of like what I was experiencing and going through. And then also it naturally kind of outcropped into like a bunch of stand up. And so I just kind of hit that from different angles, where it's just in and around the idea of being a new father and, you know, the things that you would sacrifice for your kid. And I do a whole thing about like life insurance, and now I have a life insurance policy, and how that's just basically like making a bet against my own life every month. if I lost the bet, which is, you know, kind of what life insurance is. And then about the patriarchy and how much my wife went through being pregnant, as all women go through being pregnant, and then that they just slap a man's last name on the end of the baby. See? Like, I'm like, man, the patriarchy is very powerful. And then even like, and then there'll be like a one-liner within that, that is just that, we put our son in a Batman onesie, which was really cute until I remembered what happened to Batman's parents. And so like, that's just sort of more of a one-liner, but they're all kind of like threaded together within the theme of like new parentness. So it's kind of a mix, but I like grouping like with like and transitioning from topic to topic, because it just makes it feel more organic for me of how I would have a conversation with somebody. And again, even if it's like a one-line joke, it just fits into the flow of a conversation.
Do you read the stories to your kids that you were read to as a child?
No, not yet, really. We have a bunch of new books that we've been reading to my son, but I'm more interested in introducing him to the narratives of both movie and TV and video games that I grew up with, and the things that kind of shape my sense of humor. A couple weeks ago, or this past weekend it must have been, I sat down with him, and we don't do a lot of screens with him yet, just because we have like one TV and it's sort of a little further away from his room, so he'll play with his toys and all that. But I sat him down to watch some of the old Looney Tunes cartoons, like Chuck Jones stuff. And I loved all that as a kid, and like Robin Hood Daffy. And there was something about Daffy Duck that I loved. More than Wile E. Coyote. Wile E. Coyote I was always frustrated by, although I have an appreciation for him as a tragic comedic figure at this point. But Daffy just always seemed a little more bordering on the absurd, and then would have a relationship with the audience and would be befuddled by, you know, Bugs Bunny messing with him and drawing stuff around him. And there was always that, like, he had that meta thing in and around it. And I loved that, like, the way it would wink at you as a viewer.
Breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, I love that. I really loved it. Very Brechtian, the cartoons. But yeah, I introduced him to some of those, and I'm looking forward to that. And then, you know, video games that I played as a kid, like the old adventure games, like The Secret of Monkey Island and Curse of Monkey Island and Grim Fandango and Day of the Tentacle, like they were so formative for my sense of humor and maybe my sense of problem solving. And I'm really looking forward to him playing those. And then, yeah, I'm sure there are some books that I'll get into once he gets older. I'm like, oh yeah, I'll do that. But it's been more like the cultural touchstones, even like the Mel Brooks movies and that type of thing that I watched as a kid that were kind of fun and cheeky. And I hope he enjoys those. But I'm really looking forward to introducing him to those things as he gets old.
Monkey Island was the first video game I ever encountered, so that's really cool.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Nice. Me too. Oh, what a great game. So it was, you know, you had to win sword fights with insults and witty repartee. And
yeah.
Like, that's great.
I still think of conversations in that way, where you sort of have three options and you can choose which one and then go with that.
Absolutely. And it was like, listen, sometimes you can get out of physical confrontations with wit. I'm like, I am on board with it. That seems, yeah. So
What's the best advice you've received, and what is the worst advice you've received?
I think the best advice is to be persistent. Like, you just have to keep going, even when you're frustrated. It's not, example being like the order, I can't remember who it came from. It was like one of my friends in, a friend of mine named Dan McCabe. I'm actually going to see a play of his up in Boston this coming weekend. But he said that the things that will help you make it in whatever, creative endeavor you're doing are persistence, luck, and talent in that order. And that is so, so absolutely true. Like, you need to just not quit, keep going. And then you just need to get lucky. Like, you need to have somebody recommend you to submit a packet to a place, or you just need that luck. And then talent is like a distant third. Like, obviously you need to work hard, and talent is the thing that you hopefully will come or that you have, but you can control persistence. And so that's all you can really hope for. And did you ask worst advice as well?
I did.
Boy, worst advice. And the best advice thing, sorry, on the persistence as well. It's, I think something that helped me was when I was coming up and doing theater and auditioning, I feel like it was hard to separate myself and my sense of self-worth as a artist or whatever it is, capital A artist, whatever. But
artiste.
Yeah, artiste. It was hard to separate how I felt about myself versus the work that I was doing. And I think separating yourself from it is really important. Like, it's not, if you kind of have to believe, like, no, I know how to write a funny joke. I wasn't funny today. This joke wasn't funny. This joke isn't working. Because then you view it as something outside yourself that you can fix. Yeah. And that I view as part of persistence. Like, you have to kind of divorce your sense of self-worth from the work that you make. And then you can really focus on it as work and not as like, oh, this is me. And that was one of the things about acting that I always found tricky, was like, if I walk into an audition, they're just judging me off the things that I really can't control. How tall I am, what color my eyes are, how much I weigh. You can control that, I guess, but like, more so than eye color, whatever. But I untangled all that. I was just like, no, I really enjoy comedy because it's a thing that, like, if it doesn't get a laugh, how do you fix it to get it a laugh? And that really helped. So that's sort of an offshoot of the persistence thing. It's like, be persistent, but also like, be persistent in viewing your work as work and fixing it and making the work the best that it can be without feeling like, I'm no good, I'm not funny, whatever it is. But be realistic, with yourself as well about it, which is also part of persistence. It's a good umbrella for all that.
Yeah.
And then worst advice. I've had people tell me not, like, don't leave KPMG to go to The Onion. Like, you'll take a pay cut. I had people who told me when I was in late high school, I was doing all the plays and stuff and comedy and Our Town and, the various Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, it was like tiny little roles. And one of the teachers was like, I think you're a very good actor. I hope you're not thinking of going to acting school. I was just like, all right, that's a weird thing to say. But, being on the other side of it, it's sort of, it looks like a totally impractical decision, but you never know how you're going to ping pong around and where you're going to end up. So the people who tell you not to do things, just listen to that tiny little voice inside and do the things you know you want to do and you know you're right for. And the people who are telling you to stop, just ignore them. A lot of people don't know. A lot of people like to give bad advice, so it's important to ignore advice.
Well, that is somewhat ironically really good advice.
Thank you. Or is it?
Oh, well, that is the question. Two more. I just have two more questions for you before I let you get on with the rest of your life. One is, you've talked a lot about inspirations you've had growing up and in the world of comedy. Who are some people who are on the rise that haven't necessarily broken yet, but you're aware of and you think, oh, they're ones to watch?
Oh, man. I mean, My Office Made It Work is a comedian named Josh Johnson, who it's hard to say he's on the rise. Like, he opens for Trevor now on the road. And he's done sets on Conan and stuff. And I think he'll probably have an hour in the next year or so, but he's just so incredibly funny. And he's a very unique voice. And, I really enjoy working with him and collaborating with him. We've done a couple The Daily Show has this offshoot thing that's sort of like a PBS Tavis Smiley kind of show called CP Time with Roy Wood Jr. Mm-hmm. And those have covered everything from like the birth of hip hop and how it developed, like seminal moments in hip hop, and then the Tuskegee Airmen and the history of African Americans in the military. And I've worked on a couple of those with him, and he's just like, he's got a very sharp mind and kind of this weird combination of like fast, intense comedy and then like very laconic, laid back comedy, which work seamlessly together through him. It's cool to watch, and he's incredibly funny and just a nice guy. So yeah, he's certainly on the rise. And then who else? That's the one I can think of on top of, you know, off the top of my head. I mean, well, Jabuki's already blown up, and he's like the newest correspondent at the show, Jabuki Young White. And
oh, yeah.
He had an episode of Crashing. Yeah, he's, I don't even need to mention him. He's already blown up. who else in the comedy world? I guess that's the biggest one, Josh Johnson. Yeah, I recommend it. Check out his stuff. He's very good.
I will do. I will do. And now my final question, going back to where we started, which is the slightly difficult times that we're facing on both sides of the pond. It may seem that stories and storytelling seems quite superfluous and unnecessary and sort of almost a vanity project in comparison to the troubles that are facing
sure.
both sides. But why would you say that we need stories and storytellers of all kinds during these times, not despite of?
Well, I mean, I think at any point, like, it's we're examining what it means to be human. And, you know, an example being a year ago, my wife and I were expecting our son to arrive, and I went to, and Gabe, my cousin, had tickets to see Mike Birbiglia's show, The New One, which, is all about parenthood and, you know, since went to Broadway and everything. And it really prepared me for a lot of the challenges and a lot of the absurdities and a lot of the, like, who you are before you're a parent versus who you are after you're a parent and what the difference is and if there is a difference. And I took a lot of meaning from that. It was very helpful to me and helped me frame, get me in the right frame of mind for how big parenthood was about to be. And then also to know how I was different from Mike Birbiglia. You know, he talks about sleepwalking and, you know, all the challenges that he faced. And I was, you know, fortunate to not have those challenges in my life as I was a parent, but had to face other challenges. And so, yeah, you know, that's just one example, but if he decided against telling that story, I probably would have been that much less equipped to deal with being a parent. And, you know, and then same thing, like Michael Lewis, who wrote The Big Short and Moneyball and, you know, all those terrific books. He wrote a book about parenting called Home Game, and I read that. And again, another set of the toolbox. And then Trevor's book, Born a Crime, has, you know, nothing to do with the politics of now, but is revealing about the politics of apartheid, but it's also just his personal story. And then in a weird way, because I read it last summer, it was all about being a parent. Like, it was about the decisions that his mother made and how she raised him, and, you know, that she was walking around with a crime on the street, and that was him, and, you know, and how she navigated those decisions. And I told him that. I was like, hey, I read your book, and it really felt like it was about being a parent and all the, you know, how your mother raised you. And he kind of was like, oh, I didn't think of it that way. Like, he's obviously telling the stories from his perspective and how he grew up and went on his journey from Soweto all the way kind of to The Daily Show. But I got that perspective from him, even if he wasn't necessarily intending it to be a book about parenting. So, you know, you never know what the stories you tell will inspire or what wisdom they have in them. And yeah, I think just putting them out there and sharing them can enrich other people's lives. And it's part of the, you know, the shared humanity that we all have. And it gives meaning to both the experiences that you have and helps you share them with other people, you know, audiences large and small.
What a wonderful, optimistic note to end on.
Oh, I thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been amazing.
Yeah, my pleasure. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed talking. I hope I didn't ramble on too much. So feel free to cut out anything that drags or whatever. And yeah.
No, not at all. It was brilliant and very, very profound. It seems rude to say surprisingly profound. I don't mean it as a criticism.
No, that's fine. Listen, anytime you go in with comedy and you end up with profound, it's surprising. I don't take it that way. Yeah, thanks for having me. It flew by. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for a great conversation.
You're so, so welcome. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Have a good one.